You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you I've not had the honor of yet to meet, I'm John Allen, and I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. And it really is my sincere pleasure to welcome you to our webinar this afternoon, How Faith Leaders Can Help America Heal. You know, following years, even decades of partisanship and political fragmentation here in America, the topic of national unity has felt to many like a distant memory, even nigh on to being unattainable in the present day. And I dare say that the past 5 years or so, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic and our nation's latest reckoning with systemic racism and massive income inequality and more, have put a fine point on such sentiments. Rarely in our history have a United States of America ever felt so far away, and even perhaps a disunited States of America. It was with this in mind that we at Brookings began thinking hard on the topic of national healing and reconciliation, a topic that President Biden has made central to his administration as well. And with many of our nation's wounds still so fresh, this topic is indeed quite challenging. So questions immediately rise. What does it mean to be an American today? Can we ever again see each other as fellow citizens and neighbors, even amidst such strife and conflict? Is it right or even realistic to ask Americans to begin this painful process of reconciliation and healing? And I know that each person may very fairly have different responses to these questions. Yet it is our very strong belief at Brookings that we must, as we do with so many other pressing issues, create spaces to address these difficult challenges and discuss them openly as a society and a community. We have to do this. As always, we'll leave others to draw their conclusions, but we feel the conversation that has to be had is one that will have a lasting means of healing our divisions. Here, faith-based communities and faith leaders are particularly essential and valuable components in every fabric of America. And while we in this country hold no citizen to a particular faith or creed, we do respect the role of religion and the role that it has played in formulating and sustaining an American culture and society. And what's more, many of these communities and religious leaders have been instrumental in pulling and keeping together the nation at its most difficult times and in immense hardship. They've been essential. So with that, on to today's event, and I'm very, very pleased to now introduce our special guest for the remainder of this programming, Melissa Rogers. Melissa currently serves as a special assistant to the president and executive director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. Prior, she served as the director of the Center of Religion and Public Affairs at Wake Forest University Divinity School and as a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings in our governance studies program. Few, if any, are better suited to discussing the important role of faith-based communities in healing America. We're incredibly honored by her presence with us here this afternoon. So in a few short moments, Melissa and I will have a conversation for about 30 minutes, and then we'll turn the floor over to Governance Studies Vice President and Program Director, Daryl West, to introduce and to moderate a phenomenal interfaith panel on many of these subjects. And let me add that I know very well nearly everyone on this panel, and I know them as great leaders and contributors in their own faith groups, but also to a broader faith mosaic in America that promotes religious tolerance and community resilience. And I have enormous respect for each panelist, and we are so honored by your presence with us today. So before we move on with our program today, a quick reminder that we're very much live and on the record, and audience members are welcome to submit their questions via events@brookings.edu, that's events@brookings.edu, or at Twitter via our @brookings Brookings.gov account, at Brookings.gov. So with that, let's get started. And Melissa, it's so wonderful to speak with you today, and it's great to have you back, and I cannot thank you enough for all that you are doing on this front.
So thank you so much, John.
it's just great to see you and have you back.
Thank you.
Let me start with a question I think would be natural for all of us tuning in this afternoon. Tell us what your work entails, and how does that fit with President Biden's vision for building greater unity through your office?
Great. Well, thank you so much for that very kind and generous introduction, John. It's such an honor to be back with you at Brookings. And I'm so appreciative of the leadership that you bring to Brookings generally and to this issue specifically, as well as that of Daryl West and the terrific report that you all collaborated on not too long ago, producing great food for thought for all of us. So thank you for that. I also want to thank my dear friends, EJ Dion and Bill Galston of Brookings, who I've been able to collaborate with and cherish a friendship with for many years. And thanks to all the distinguished panelists and indeed everybody who's joining us today. I know so many who are joining us are playing such an important role right now in helping the nation heal. So we couldn't have a better time or a better group for conversation. And as you mentioned, it's a great honor to serve President Biden in this White House. We are moving forward on many fronts, including this front of, you know, working with faith and community partners to serve people in need, which is the mission of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. And I know Brookings has a long history here, given, the presence of John Diulio, who has been associated with Brookings for many years and served as the first director of this White House office when President George W. Bush established it more than 20 years ago. So that's a great history. And of course, John is a wonderful and cherished friend and partner in this work as well. And so the office started, I think, over a felt need to ensure that we were doing our utmost through the White House work to not forget the very important role of civil society in all the work that we do, but particularly in serving people in need, which brings us together across many different political and ideological and even religious divisions or differences. So I think George W. Bush had the right intuition to think that we need a place where a front door at the White House where faith and community groups can go there and know where to knock and get some help in navigating what can be a very complex federal government, and also find a way to find others, including government, but not limited to government, that want to serve people in need. And so that was a process that George W. Bush set out establishing this office and establishing centers for faith-based and neighborhood partnerships across the federal agencies, which I hope we'll get to talk to about a little bit more later. So that office was established, and then President Barack Obama took office, and some were speculating about whether a president of a different party would continue the signature initiative of a president, a Republican president. And indeed, President Obama did. And of course, that was no surprise to those who know him, who, you know, he got his start working on the South Side of Chicago, working with faith and community groups on trying to boost economic opportunity and meet people's needs there. So President Obama and then Vice President Biden continued that office while putting their own stamp on its practices and policies and even its name. And that work continued in important ways. And then just this year, President Biden returned to the White House and reestablished the office. And we've been so glad to do that. It comes at such an important time, as you mentioned, with the COVID challenges, just to take the most prominent one. We have seen faith and community groups during this COVID challenge have to reinvent the whole way in which they serve people. especially when the crisis was particularly acute. You think about the ways that you need to run a food pantry. That's very different from the way you would run a food pantry in non-COVID conditions. And we also remember, I think all of us, the pictures that we saw of cars lined up down the highway for miles, for food assistance. And so, you know, that just broke everyone's heart. And I think faith and community leaders immediately sprung into action and figured out ways to serve people in those circumstances. And really, I mean, kept people's life and livelihoods together in such a crucial time. And we just cannot highlight that enough, because the ingenuity that that took and the commitment and the heart that that took was phenomenal. And we're still working on many problems, but I just want to really tip our hats to faith and community providers for, you know, really stepping into that gap. Of course, now we're working on a number of challenges that are related to COVID, but not only COVID. You mentioned systemic racism and economic recovery, which continue to be huge issues, as well as deep political polarization. Those are clearly some frontline challenges for all of us. And so one thing we've done is start what's called a COVID-19 Community Corps. And if you look at that, the founding members of that COVID-19 Community Corps, you'll see people from the right and the left politically and ideologically and the right and various religious traditions and people of no religious faith who have said, I want to help America get vaccinated. And I want to help America, you know the facts about the virus and the vaccine. So that has been an amazing effort already, and one that we're looking forward to building upon. And I would say that there is continuing to be these centers across the various federal agencies. And I would cite partnerships of the Center at the Health and Human Services Department, for example, to work with the National League of Cities on boosting economic recovery, in part by highlighting efforts of faith and community leaders, which, you know, even though it's not well known, faith and community leaders play a big role in helping people to get a job, the unemployed, and to help the underemployed get trained and get into better paying jobs. FEMA is making sure that faith and community organizations have the information about preparing for the upcoming hurricane season. And we just find here again that faith and community groups are the indispensable partners between government and people who are struggling. And so that is very important. And then over at USAID, our center there is working with faith and community partners on crises around the world, including one in Ethiopia right now, to address threatening hunger and suffering. And so all of these partnerships can be financial or non-financial, but they are very different, some very formal, some informal, but they all, I think, play a role in helping our nation heal. I'll just mention that the other thing that I'm doing is working at the intersection of faith and public policy to just deal with some of the issues there, sometimes fraught, helping people to understand how we try to comply with the spirit and the letter of the Constitution, and making sure that we're listening to everybody, because Joe Biden wants to be president for all Americans.
Well, listening to that long list of things that you're doing, I'm trying to think, when are you sleeping? But as you well know, this is a 24, almost a 24/7 job. It really is.
We're
so glad you're doing it. Now, you just touched on something. I think it's really important. And I think for many Americans, when we think about the issue of reconciliation and healing, we don't automatically come to the faith dimension of reconciliation and healing and the role of faith-based communities and faith leaders. Now, as you pointed out properly, the Constitution is pretty clear on this matter. So for our audience today, how should we be thinking about religion's role in American public life and the role that these communities can play in doing this? And you've touched on some of this, but I think a specific explanation might be quite helpful.
Yes, and that's a great question, because sometimes we find people are quite confused about what the Constitution says and even about whether an office like the one I run should exist in right. the government. So, you know, the Constitution says that the government can't back religion. It can't be promoting theology and, you know, telling people that they should believe one way or the other. But it also says that people of faith have the rights to express and practice their faith, and that the government needs to protect those rights. And so we work right there to say that it is not the government's role to promote theology or religion, but it is government's role to work with all citizens who want to be, in our office's case, helping people in need. And it would be silly and hostile to religion for the government not to work with faith and community groups in these situations. So it's incumbent on the government to engage with everyone, including faith groups, in this task. And of course, we have to do that in a way that treats all faiths equally, does not favor one over the other, and that also importantly includes people who say, I'm not a person of faith, but I want to serve people in need too. So those are just some of the very basic rules. Our Constitution, has the separation of church and state, but that doesn't mean that government and religious groups can't talk to one another, can't work together on issues of shared concern. And we've gone over this particularly with all these COVID vaccination sites setting up in houses of worship. And we've been encouraging government to say, you can work with houses of worship on doing this because this is a shared public health aim.
And this goes to the intersection of the two forces within your office, which is that's the perfect example where houses of worship really promoted community solutions. And that's, exactly. I think that's the synergy that we're seeking to have here. That's really important.
Exactly.
So let me just make a couple comments. Of course, there's no such thing as a monolithic religious community. The wonder, the marvelous dimension of our various faiths means that we have various approaches to both the communities, but also their roles with the individual citizens who either attend the church or who they live with in their community. So they can be a great force for healing, but they can also be a force for division as well. And as you have seen in the earliest moments of this administration, what gives you cause for hope, or do you have cause for hope that in fact these religious communities can help the nation to heal our political divides, to get us back on our feet after COVID, to deal with this issue of systemic racism and the profound political polarization? Can it be a force for good, or is this going to be a force potentially to increase the polarization?
You know, I really do know that we face a lot of challenges. No one can close their eyes to that. And if we do, we're not going to be able to solve the problem adequately. But I have a lot of cause for hope as well. And, you know, I think somebody that holds the job that I do just can't get away from being hopeful, because every day I have people reaching out to me, including the panelists that you're going to be speaking with in a little bit, reaching out to me saying, how can I help? Or here's what I'm doing. Do you think by combining our efforts, we could make this effort more than the sum of its parts? And that, without fail, that happens multitudes of times every single day. And so I'm very hopeful. I think to go back to COVID, we have seen everyone from, you know, the National Association of Evangelicals to the multi-faith faiths for vaccines, pulling out all the stops to get people healthy and building bridges across divides to do so. So, you know, people, and there are people in those groups who disagree with the administration about certain things. But our office has majored on the fact that we want to work with everybody, including those who have serious differences with the Biden administration. Because again, the president wants to be president of all Americans. So where we can agree, let's work together. And that'll not only do a whole lot of good on that particular issue, but it'll build a relationship that may help us to overcome some of the differences of misunderstanding and polarization. Also, I would mention, for example, on racial justice issues, a uniting focus has been concerns about racial disparities. And we all know that the past year has been a real revelation for many of us on racial disparities just because of the COVID virus. But really, those disparities abound in economic opportunity and education, so many other places where just because of someone's race, they end up getting sicker and having less opportunity. And that is just wrong. And people agree about that from many different ideological and political and religious perspectives. And that brings us together. So, for example, I think about a grant opportunity that HHS just recently announced about a navigator that helps people get insurance when they don't have it. And this particular grant opportunity focuses, asks people who are applying to tell them how they have been reaching out to underserved communities. And that's so important because we want to close these gaps and have everybody have access to quality, affordable health care. And so, you know, those are just a couple of examples where we're finding that even with the challenges and even noting that sometimes religion can spark division, that there are a lot of ways in which we can come together across our differences and do a lot of good together. And that, so that continues to inspire me each day.
Well, that inspiration is going to have to carry us through some of these difficult moments. And, you know, one of the things that in my recent experience, and in fact, working very closely with some of the wonderful people on this panel, we were asked by the Secretary of Homeland Security what we believed could be some steps to deal with the violence against our faith communities. You know, it is such a horrendous reality that many of our faith communities cannot practice their faith without fear for their physical safety. And again, many of the panelists, we witnessed this personally. We've seen of late a spike in anti-Semitic attacks in the United States, as well as a rise in hate crimes against Muslims, against Sikhs, against the predominantly Black Christian communities in the South. What, in your mind, are the kinds of policies and partnerships that we should be pursuing actively to provide protection to these precious communities to address these problems?
You know, I want to start out by thanking you, John, for your leadership of that effort through the Department of Homeland Security. I read the report. I actually read the report when it came out. I skimmed it, and then during the transition, I really sat down and read every word. And as one who's done reports like that, I know that that report was not produced without incredible number of hours of work and collaboration. So let me thank you and the panelists, because it is a rich report that everybody should read and that contains not only great context, but actually really actionable suggestions about what DHS and other parts of government can do. For example, your wonderful suggestion about creating more technical assistance for those who want to apply for nonprofit security grants, which are grants that are given to faith and community groups that are under some threat, like the groups that you mentioned. And this, you know, this appropriation for this grant program is there and welcome that it's been strengthened recently, including by President Biden. At the same time, we know that not everybody has a team of lawyers to help them produce a grant application. Sure. And that's not right, because some people who are the most threatened would not necessarily have that kind of assistance and experience. So what can we do to, you know, make sure that there's more technical assistance for people that are applying for these funds that they really need? And your report is a source of great granular, actionable items that is, you know, on many desks right now as we think about what we can do to improve in this area. I would also cite the president's signing recently of the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act and the Jabara Hire No Hate Act. And what this act does, and the president spoke about it when he signed it a few weeks ago, it gives us a bunch of new tools to try to prevent incidents of hate that are unlawful, and also to, prosecute or combat those hate crimes when they unfortunately do happen. And you'll may be aware that Attorney General Garland released a memo just recently about the Department of Justice's early efforts to implement this law. And he talked about several things like increasing resources and coordination to combat hate crimes and hate incidents, expediting the review of hate crimes, increasing the department's language access capabilities, because we find that the reporting of hate crimes is not nearly what it should be. And oftentimes we find that there are language barriers. So what can we do to overcome those barriers so that we can get the reporting and prevent hate crimes moving forward and bring justice where hate crimes have occurred? The memo of the Attorney General also talks about restoring the role of the Community Relations Service at the Department of Justice, that I know you may be familiar with, that really plays a role in helping create community understanding and being there with the community when it's in crisis. The other interesting point that the Attorney General made was a suggestion about creating what he called district alliances against hate. And he encouraged each U.S. Attorney's office to consider what it could do in using its convening power to bring together communities, law enforcement, civil rights coordinators, to talk about what the community is experiencing in terms of threats in this area and how the community could come together to respond. And so I think that's just a wonderful suggestion of a way that we can really use the convening power of government across the nation to make, to make strides in this area, which is, as you say, quite needed.
Well, the Department of Justice, I think, has really leaned hard into this issue, and the Attorney General in particular. As the panelists will remember, as we dug into this issue, and as we looked at every one of these horrendous acts against these communities, almost invariably, the common thread that ran through them all was domestic white supremacy and extremists, white extremists. And I'm very pleased to see that not just in the civil community, not just in the context of the Department of Justice, but Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has also mandated that the services are going to look inside their ranks for those same kinds of individuals who either terrorize their fellow citizens in uniform or join these organizations when they come out. And that was in the background of every one of these horrific events targeted against our faith communities and our precious fellow Americans worshiping in their own way, just trying to worship in a manner that facilitates the security of their families and their congregations. And they suffered so terribly because of this. So I really commend the Attorney General and the Department of Justice in this regard. Just a couple more minutes. Can I ask a quick question? What do you see perhaps as a potential role for think tanks in this entire area that you're talking about? Obviously, you're experiencing one right now, but is there a role for think tanks to be helping you and helping the president in this process?
Absolutely. I think your stewardship of your time to lead that report that you wrote for DHS, and, writing the report wasn't the only thing. You held a bunch of meetings, you went out and talked to people, you used the convening power of government, but also your convening power, given what you have done in terms of your leadership in our nation. And let me just pause and say thank you for that, because you have, your leadership there has been tremendous. And then bringing that into the Brookings leadership and combining it now is just packs quite a punch. And so I think that your leadership has been instrumental, and your willingness to take time to lead the kind of advisory council that you did, that's a big hunk of time. And you being willing to do that is one way that a think tank can contribute. Also, I would cite the report that you and Daryl produced that has, it also sits on my desk, and I've shared it with many in government who have reacted very positively to it. And the president has continued to ask for ideas, more and more ideas to try to unify America. And that report has been very helpful to us in teeing up new ideas. So there are no shortage of ways that that ThinkTanks can do so, including through this conversation. And while I won't necessarily be able to stay for the full time of the panelists, I will go back when I have a moment to get the rest of the transcript and the audio, because, you know, the ideas that are produced can be exceedingly helpful and help us to get outside the governmental bubble, if you will, to make sure that we are getting the best ideas possible and coming together as a nation. So I think there's absolutely a key role for think tanks to play in unifying America. And I especially appreciate Brookings' historical role in recognizing the faith community. It's not every think tank that has really taken seriously the intersection of faith, public policy, and law, and also that has taken very seriously the faith community's role in contributing to challenging problems, whether it's the problem of poverty or racism or anything else. It's not every think tank that will take these issues on. And Brookings has done it historically, and you have done it very prominently through your leadership. So I really thank you and appreciate that deeply in terms of the work that I do right now.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm very grateful for that. Let me ask one quick question. We just have a couple of minutes left. You obviously, as we've said, you've got a full plate. It's early in the administration. We all acknowledge how much is to be done, but this it's very clear you're getting after it. Are there some policies or models that are out there that you have seen, or as you would like to, as you have the time and you have the resources, that you'd like to implement that you haven't yet had the chance to embrace?
Yeah, well, that list is very, very long. But I will say just a few things that we've found that can be helpful in dealing with the polarization that the country currently faces. One is to make sure that we allow people to name their fears. And here I want to credit my colleague and friend, Pete Wehner. When EJ and I were working on a report recently, Pete made sure that to say that it's so important that we recognize what people fear, because right now, a lot of people fear on different sides that the way that they would like to live their life is being threatened. And they see that maybe they won't be able to hold fast to their values because of threats. And that's people on all sides. Everybody's scared about what the other side might do to them if they get political power. And Pete encouraged us to think about letting people name their fears and being honest about that. And I think that is a really helpful thing to do. Another very helpful thing to do is just listening to people, as we've already talked about, and listening to people before policy decisions are made. It's very important that we call people in to tell us about their ideas, even when they may differ from some of the policies that President Biden has already announced that he is supporting, to understand why people differ and to give them their say. Because this is, you know, this is governance. This is where we bring everybody in to listen to all Americans about the issues that are dear to them. And so really listening to them and whenever possible, getting that some in front of policymaking, so that we can give due respect to different views. And indeed, so we can learn something and sometimes change our views, sometimes modulate something because of what we've learned. So I would say that. And also, I think finding ways to serve together across our differences, which just brings us back to where we started. A lot of times that can be a relationship builder. And so trying to find more opportunities for people of different faiths and beliefs to work side by side really breaks the ice and helps us to see the good in one another in a way that is very powerful. So I would say those are just three very simple things that we're focused on. And we would welcome everyone's suggestion about building greater unity in our country, because we do not have to be as divided as we are. And we are determined to make progress on this. So I'm happy to receive everyone's ideas about this. And just want to thank again, the faith and community leaders that have joined us for really embodying the spirit of generosity and kindness and listening to one another. which we find so often and which often goes unremarked upon and doesn't get reported on, but I see it every day. And by golly, we are very, very thankful for it and see it as a path that will help us to unify moving forward.
Well, Melissa Rogers, Special Assistant to the President and Executive Director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, we are so fortunate as a country to have you serving where you are right now. Thank you for your time this afternoon. Thank you for your views and your labors, not just on behalf of our communities and our faith-based communities, but on behalf of every one of us, all Americans, to heal these divides, to reconcile our communities, and to do it in the manner that you are. So we can't thank you enough for joining us, Melissa, and we wish you continued success in this important mission that you have. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's so appreciated, and I really wish everyone the best and look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you, Melissa. And now over to Daryl West, who will run the panel this afternoon, and I'm going to tune in, so I'm looking forward to it. Thank you, Daryl. And you're muted.
Sorry about that. Thank you, John and Melissa. That was a terrific conversation with lots of terrific insights. I love the idea of a COVID community core. It really highlights the crucial role of local organizations in moving our country forward. So it's a great way to kick off our discussion about ways to heal America. So as John and Melissa pointed out, we face several challenges right now: a high level of political polarization, a loss of trust and confidence in government, a tendency to treat opponents as enemies. Yet this period also represents a major learning moment for the United States. It's a time for all of us to reflect on how we got to this point and what we can do to heal our country. And one key ingredient in reconciliation, as our previous session just indicated, is the crucial role of faith communities in that effort. Historically, our faith communities have played a very important role in bringing people together. They help individuals overcome differences. They provide a means for personal connection, and they inspire others in the community to do a much better job. So we can't really deal with our divisions unless we come together in these very basic ways. To help us understand these issues, we're delighted to have five distinguished experts with us today. Salam Al-Mariati is the president and co-founder of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Reverend Cassandra Bledsoe is the immediate past national chaplain of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. Richard Cole is the executive director of the Department of Justice, Peace, and Human Development of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Nathan Diamond is the executive director of the Orthodox Union Advocacy Center. And Reverend Randy Vaughn is the senior pastor of Mount Sinai Baptist Church. And if you have any questions for our panelists, I would encourage you to email them to us at events@brookings.edu or to tweet at BrookingsGov. That's G-O-V. I also want to thank David Weinberg, John Canning Jr., and Carrie and Michael Sachs for their generous support of this project. So I want to start with a question for each of our panelists. And we'll just go down the list here. How do each of you see the issue of societal divisions, and what is your organization doing to heal the country? And Salam, let's start with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Daryl, and thank you for Brookings and convening these wonderful people. I'm very honored to be with, I'm very privileged to be with this prestigious group. I think the problem and the answer lie in religion. The problem is religious nationalism. When religion is used as fuel to push a political ideological agenda, but it has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with power. It has to do with supremacy. And therefore the answer lies in religion. Because the way I believe all of our religions have been founded, they've been founded on the basis of human equality. that God's will is diversity. God's will is pluralism. And it's not just his will, it's something that's good for us. So our work together with Randy, with Cassandra, with Nathan, and I'm glad to meet Richard, is based on that cornerstone of faith, of human equality and religious pluralism as the answer to this problem of supremacy that has been fueled by religious nationalism. And I believe that religious nationalism is now the major threat to all of our religions, not secularism. Secularism is actually the avenue by which all religions can flourish equally. So we need to rethink how we approach this problem from the standpoint of religion to begin with.
And Salam, what is your organization doing to heal the country?
Well, we do much. The fact that we engage one another is one very important part of the agenda for the Muslim Public Affairs Council and for all American Muslim organizations, is to be known, to engage. The Quran tells us, repel evil with that which is good and better, so that the one with whom there is hostility will become as if he is your closest and warmest friend. So we work on a social agenda. We don't need to convert one another to our religion or to even our ideology, but we need to convert people from opposition to coalition, from enmity to friendship. And we have programs throughout the country. For example, we have something called Mustard Seed. And in the Quran and the Bible, it talks about how no matter how little something is, if God wants to bring it to light, it will come to light. And so every small act of compassion can make a world of difference. And that's our Mustard Seed program.
A great idea. Cassandra, your thoughts on our divisions and what is your organization doing to heal the country?
Well, I agree with Salam. At the root cause of everything is God, good and evil. If you read our Bible instructs us and teaches us that these are the days, the last days, and these are the days that we are living in. So in that, how do we get along with one another, respect one another, and how do we live peacefully in these days? The organization that I'm speaking for is the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. At the forefront of that is police reform. We have been at the table. We've had many community meetings via Zoom and webinars, trainings. But in addition to that, beyond looking to look at diversity only at race and whether it's police community relations, we must embrace the diversity of thought. And the diversity of thought goes across every religion, every nationality, and every age. And that is what we're looking to do, is to bring in as General Allen said, the great thinkers, and not only embracing the diversity of thought, but being able to have everyone listen, talk, and understand.
Thank you. Richard, your thoughts on our divisions, and what is the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops doing?
Well, thank you very much, Darren. Let me start by joining and thanking Brookings for bringing us together, so grateful to be with these wonderful and distinguished individuals to be able to share our thoughts. And indeed, one of the things that has struck me so far is how much we do have in common as members of a faith community here in the United States, and how wonderful it is to be able to have this kind of dialogue. I was rereading Fratelli Tutti, Pope Francis's most recent encyclical, in anticipation of our conversation. One of the things that struck me is the centrality of interfaith dialogue and how Pope Francis challenges the faith communities of all religious denominations to work together in seeking the transcendent truth. And what is that transcendent truth? I think it's already been very well stated. The common humanity that we share as brothers and sisters, our human dignity that we need to recognize and honor, and our commitment to human rights and universal development, inequality, that will be our way of honoring God's call to us, and which is a call that we share with all faiths and indeed with people of no faith as well. And that common humanity, that recognition of our brotherhood and sisterhood, I think leads to some of the suggestions that we've already heard. The importance of dialogue. And here I want to commend Melissa Rogers for her role in the administration in fostering that dialogue. Whether we agree or whether we disagree with all elements of policy, the dialogue, which is built on mutual respect and on listening, is such an important part of how we will heal our society and indeed our world. And I think we start with listening, we continue with dialogue, and we build towards action, towards common action that we can take together to address the pressing problems that we face as a society. As one example, many of you know, we have the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, which invests in community-based organizations across the country that are directed towards alleviating the consequences of poverty and really empowering community leaders to be able to champion their interests as they best recognize them, in recognition that they are the ones who have the best understanding of what their communities need. Many of those organizations are based on faith communities that are non-Catholic, non-Christian, and we welcome collaborating with those communities as we do indeed with purely secular communities. So I think that this conversation and some of the suggestions is the path forward that we can offer, and we can be servants and hopefully serve as models of the kind of dialogue and collaboration that can truly heal our culture.
Well, that is definitely inspiring. Nathan, I'd love to get your thoughts on how you see the divisions and also what your center is working on.
Thank you. And I will also add my thanks to Brookings and General Allen and all of you for putting this important discussion together, and how honored I am to be with my colleagues. I'll save us some time by associating myself with the remarks that have been made so far and say amen to the fundamental points that, you know, the fundamental thing that perhaps the great faiths that are represented here have to contribute to this is the recognition that each human being is created in the image of God. I think if I may, the core of the divisions, of the divisiveness that we have in the United States currently, I'm going to quote a more secular source, if you will, and that would be you know, Franklin Roosevelt's famous Four Freedoms speech, which was illustrated by Norman Rockwell. And as we emerge, hopefully, from this year and a half of the most intense period of the pandemic, I think a lot of the fuel for divisions in this country were people having great fear. And, you know, as that famous address talked about, you know, what society needs to deliver for people is a freedom from fear and a freedom from want. And both of those things were really catalyzed in people's lives in very real ways by the dislocations and the disruptions of the pandemic. But the role that faith can play, which Melissa already referenced in the opening presentation and others have as well, is just the engine of the faith communities to try and give people solace and comfort in the face of fear, and actually also help them with their material wants through good works and charity, and to pick up on what Richard said toward the end, that what we see, what our organization has done, and what I know the other major faith groups engage in, is service to people in need. And very often in coalition with people from other communities. And that is not only alleviating those fears, but it's also building building community and breaking down divisions in a very significant and important way. Some people, were scratching their heads a few weeks ago when my organization, Orthodox Jewish Organization, launched a campaign to raise funds to purchase oxygen concentrators for India, which is in the much, deeper throes of the COVID crisis than we are, thank God, in the United States right now. But from the perspective of our community, every life is precious. And now that we're in a position to try to help beyond our community, we're eager to do that. So I think just as a last point, that this is also tied into, the unique promise that the United States has made since its founding, which underlies religious freedom and the ability for many people of many different faiths to flourish in this country. Perhaps best articulated, or one of the best articulations of it, was by George Washington in his letter to the Jewish community of Newport, Rhode Island, in which he talked about the United States, not giving it gives to bigotry no sanction, is his most famous line. Made more famous now thanks to Hamilton, is that Washington also quoted the phrase, right? Every person should be able to sit over under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall make him afraid. And in quoting that verse in his letter, Washington, at the outset of this country, was setting out the promise, which has taken a lot of work, and we're still working on realizing it, obviously, but was setting out the promise that freedom of religion is reliant upon a freedom from fear, and is also reliant on a freedom from want. And the engine that allows society to build itself and bring all those things together so everyone can enjoy freedom of religion, can enjoy freedom from want, and enjoy freedom from fear, is a virtuous circle, if you will.
Absolutely. If we could make progress on any of it, that would certainly make a big difference. Randy, I want to bring you into the conversation and get your thoughts on how you see the divisions and also what your congregation is doing. Yeah, we're not hearing you. Are you unmuted?
Thank you. Sorry about that. I'm probably the most of the not so capable with technology, but here I am. Thank you, Daryl, for hosting this meeting, and certainly to the general and Melissa. Again, it's good to tell my colleagues that we work together and flew over the country and looking at various situations of disenchantment, hurt, pain, and then we're able to put together a report that has already been referred to. When I was asked to be a part of this panelist, I didn't know who would be my colleagues or fellow spokespersons, and it was in fear that I sort of took this opportunity or this engagement. I was quite relieved when I found out that it was Nathan, it was Salam, it was Cassandra. Good to meet you, Richard. I'm a bit more comfortable. We've all been in discussions with each other. But I'm reminded of one thing, and that is from the national anthem, which we so celebrate. It ends in a question. Question at the end of our national anthem says, does that star-spangled banner yet wave over the land of the free and the home of the brave? What a question. What insight I think it really calls for, because it suggests that star-spangled banner can at some point not wave, and another flag would fly over what we call this United States of America. I wish I had all of your insights before I began to ponder this question that was placed before us. I pondered the question, and I'm glad that I did. It says, how faith leaders can help America heal. How faith leaders can help America heal. And when I just study, go to the dictionary and look at the word heal, that means to make whole. To make whole. It's just not giving a piece of bread or seeing after the sick, but actually to make whole without problems. That raises the question in my mind again. Has America ever been whole? Has she ever been well? One of the greatest problems that America has had and has never dealt with or gave simple attempt. It's America dealing with color. That has been a problem. It's still a problem. As we've come through this past year, I need not remind you of the problems that we have had here in America just dealing with color. What I thought to suggest to us is that if we had the time, that we could actually, before we start trying to heal, is really diagnose the problem. We've been throwing a lot of symptoms around. But what is the real problem? What's wrong? Maybe you know and I have not been told. But I think that for us, at some point, at some future date, if it so be, if we could put our minds together and let's see if as doctors, quote unquote, we can really decide the problem. Because if we work at solving the problem from our own perspectives, someone said that the camel was made by a committee that came together to design a horse. And as a result, we can find ourselves really tackling a whole lot of symptoms, but never touching the problem. And so I would hope that we can eventually find our ways there. I need not remind you of problems. Polarization is really killing America right now. Political polarization right now, to get the Democrats and the Republicans to come to the agreement on whether we're going to drink cold water or warm water. I don't know. It's a problem. It's a vote. It's a 51-49 split. It's almost un-American to think that this is where we have come. That because one group is in favor of one thing and another group and what we're seeing even now, old laws that we thought we had overcome, like Jim Crow, Jim is still crowing. And there was the craziness that are going back to recount votes that have been voted so that certain people will not be able to vote. Georgia, you can't go to the polls and vote on a Sunday morning. Pews to the polls. And if you do go, don't get thirsty because no one can give you a glass of water. That is a sick America. And so how do we propose or can we propose as leaders to come to such a massive subject? General, I know you're listening and God knows we love working with you, but whatever influence that you may have, Randy Vaughn takes this subject serious, not just for public discussion, national anything, but it's larger than that. And I say to us, because again, and I'll close. on it, that we've come, we've all learned how to work together. We've learned how to put our Bible, our own personal faith book, not aside, but before us, but we know how to work with Salam, with Quran. We don't put our books in front of us because we know we got to work with Nathan and the Torah and the Jewish books. We've learned how to put that on the side, excuse me, so that we can work together. And I'm sure, Richard, you the same. But at the same time, until we are able to come together to know what the true diagnosis is and how it is that if we get to the problem, we can hurriedly resolve some of the symptoms that we find taking on in America. Now, the great question is, I deliberately said that I pastored the Mount Sinai Church, Port Arthur, Texas, and thank God for 38 years there. But I've served our national convention in many ways, even as ambassador to many of the foreign countries to talk with religious leaders, from Israel to the Vatican, sir, the World Council of Churches in Geneva. I've done all of that. But it's not important about what I've done. It's what I'm doing. We decided that we would lead the National Convention into the American Red Cross to deal with disaster management. And the main thing about that was Black people for years have been treated as victims. Everywhere it occurs, you rush stuff in for the poor, Black and brown. But what we decided to do was go to the table and say, here we come, we want to be volunteers. And someone said, what do you all do? I say, with 8 million people, we can do what we want to do. And as a result, we were accepted with MOU power and status into the National VOAD. And as of this day, those organizations are working together in that area. Locally, we've teamed up with Southern Baptist churches and other churches to participate with Black folk dollars on the table, not just white dollars, but Black dollars on the table, working together the common cause. Last thing I would say at this moment is we are plagued by religious infighting, not just Christians and Muslim, Christians and Jews, but Christians and Christians. The language has been changed. Strong words like evangelism has now become a political expression. And so we really don't know where to stand. Ever diagnose what the real problem is. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, thank you. And I agree that question of wholeness, or perhaps more aptly, the lack of wholeness, is certainly fundamental in all of these discussions. So, Salam, I want to come back to you. What kinds of changes have the potential to generate healing, and how can faith communities be helpful in doing that?
Well, I think that there are two fundamental concerns to Nathan's point about, you know, the four freedoms that FDR mentioned: the freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of speech, freedom of worship. And coming together, we work on those freedoms. So it's important for all of us to be seen together, working collectively for whoever is harmed, regardless of their religious background. And we did that, you know, we came together working on this committee that was convened by General Allen and his leadership in securing houses of worship. And we went to San Diego, where a synagogue was attacked and people were killed. And 10 miles down the road, Randy and I were there, and the same man had attacked the mosque. So it's this attack on us is common. So going through that work of developing a security model, how to make houses of worship secure so people don't fear going into a mosque or a synagogue or a church or a temple where they can convene. That fundamental security is critical in the work between our faith-based organizations and our government through the work of Melissa Rogers and the faith-based office. And working on affordable housing. I mean, in LA, we have a terrible homelessness problem because there's no affordable housing now. And now tents are coming to our doorstep of people who are homeless. And so what do we as people of faith have to do with that? We have everything to deal with that problem. So dealing with the fundamental fears of people, dealing with poverty together, going through the pain together, I think would do a lot in bringing us forward. The last thing I want to say, you know, for us as Muslims this week, there was a family that was attacked in Canada, which brings us to this notion that our problems are not so much south of the border. Our problems are north of the border as well. And there is a transnational white supremacist movement that is infecting America. And our government has to take this problem seriously, as the general eloquently articulated in his remarks. He himself is taking this issue as a priority, and so is Brookings. So I appreciate that. But I believe there's a lot to do now on that issue. So on the one hand, we have this problem. On the other hand, today is a historic day for us as American Muslims because the first American Muslim judge has been appointed and confirmed by the U.S. Senate now to serve on the federal bench. And so it gives us hope. And I think we have to stress on the hope, stress on these great people that we have assembled in working together to come up with solutions. But understand that even though God has allowed us to have different religions, there's still one message, and that is to believe in God, to believe in the human family, and then go and do the good work.
Yeah, that is an important step forward, getting someone on the bench. So congratulations on that. Cassandra, what kinds of changes are you looking for?
I am looking in, as a Christian, as a believer. You know, in Christianity, we say, by his stripes, we are healed. Many of us preach sermons and believe truly if we could just touch the hem of his garment. But all of us believe in every faith that we must love one another. The change that I'm looking for is for those of us who have professed to know Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior, that we will step forward with love and not hate, and that the world will see our love for every single person on earth. We will not be able to say out of our mouths and be double-minded. True change comes not only just by professing Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, been able to be able to act upon that out of your heart that is truly changed for Salam, for Richard, for Nathan, for Randy, for you, Daryl, and for the rest of the world to say that we are Christians and that they know us by our love, that we are believers in God and they know us all by our love, that we would put down our weapons and study war no more. If that change could come with absolute respect and love for one another, then it will be well with my soul.
Thank you. Richard, what kind of changes are you looking for that you think have the potential to generate healing, and how can faith communities help implement those ideas?
Thank you, Daryl. I'd like to go back to Fratelli Tutti and some of the work that USCCB were trying to do to implement that. And we have a new program that we are developing called the Civilize It program. program. And the goal, as it's described, is to build a better kind of politics. And it builds on so many of the wonderful statements that my fellow panelists have already articulated so well. Really, the importance and centrality of human dignity, the importance, once again, of listening with attention and not just with our ideological predispositions, of conversing and entering into dialogue with mutual respect and, dare we say it, with mutual love, which is, I think, what all of our religious traditions call us to do, and then to see common areas of action that we can implement. I think when we started thinking about this civilized program, we thought, wouldn't this be a program to roll out with our colleagues in Congress, with members of the faith community that serve the public good and government? But I think now we realize that we as physicians need to heal ourselves first. We need to apply some of the lessons of this program internally in our own faith community. And I'll speak for our own Catholic community as an example of a place where dialogue and respect and healing need to take place. And we think that the result of this civilized program, which is a methodological solution, that we will lead to practical implementations. We will recall once again our common brotherhood and sisterhood as children of God. And we will recognize that we live with creative tension. And that recognizes the point very beautifully made previously, that diversity is a great gift. And the diversity will lead to creative tension, which, if we honor in a mutually respectful way, will generate solutions and outcomes that will far transcend what any one of us or any one of our communities alone could have achieved. So I'm hopeful that this methodology will be useful, and welcome the opportunity to share it in further detail offline in any way that would be helpful.
That does sound promising. Thank you. Nathan, what kind of changes do you think have the potential to generate healing?
So I think I want to pick up again on a word that Richard used, which is the word diversity, which is much talked about in American society right now. And suggest that, you know, and again, I think this is a role for faith-informed knowledge to play in generating healing in society, is that the faiths, as the great faiths, as it has been said, including Judaism, puts a real positive affirming value on diversity. There's a passage in the Talmud that talks about the fact, right, when God created the world, God created initially one human being, Adam, and then Eve, but all of the human race descends from this one initial creation. And the Talmud remarks, you know, to say, you know, look how great God is, and compared to a king, you know, a mortal human king, if a king would mint coins from a single mold, all the coins would look the same. But God has created an entire, you know, species of humanity from one original mold, namely Adam, and we all look different, let alone have different thoughts and different passions and emotions and everything else that makes us individual. And it's putting a real affirmative faith-based value, if you will, on God's creation of diversity. And while in the social science context or in the political context right now, diversity right now is talked about in the sense of making sure we have different perspectives around the table and different representations around the table, and that's important. That lens on diversity is not necessarily one that gives diversity that kind of, I think, affirmational, aspirational meaning. In the same sense, it's because it's more in the political sphere, I think it has more to do with, you know, is the pie getting sliced up in an equitable way, which again is very important and very fundamental in our society. There's great inequity. The pie does need to be divided in an equitable way, but that relates to the freedom from want, right? That's a very almost utilitarian understanding of why should we care about diversity? Why should we care about representation, et cetera? But I think what the faith communities can bring to the conversation, and that leads to an important component of the healing that we are talking about today, is this affirmational, aspirational value that we're all created in the image of God, and God deliberately created us all quite, quite differently. And that has a this aspirational value, which if society as a whole would be more embracing of, that would have a more healing effect and minimize the focus on the divisions rather than the commonality.
Thank you. So Randy, I want to get your thoughts on the changes that you think would make the greatest difference. And then we're going to go to audience questions, and people can send their questions to events@brookings.edu. So Randy, your thoughts.
I'm going to give you back some time, but I work every day in prayer on a passage found in the Chronicles that I believe is an answer for a world. And it simply states, if my people who are called by my name, that is God speaking, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, very important word, and turn from their wicked way, then I will hear from heaven. I will give their sin, and I will heal their land.
Terrific. That is powerful. So we're getting lots of questions from the audience. So I'm going to throw these questions out. Any of our panelists who want to jump in and answer them, feel free to do so. So the first question is, how does one address the reality that many people seem to value their political opinions over the teachings of their faith? Any of you who want to comment on that?
Can you repeat that, Darrell?
How does one address the reality that many people value their political opinions over the teachings of their faith?
Well, I think, go ahead, Richard.
No, please, you go.
No.
You guys are both way too polite.
Well, I'll be very brief to allow time. And it comes back to a point made in Fratelli Tutti, I think, which is that we have lost contact with the transcendent truth of all religions. And to that end, the encyclical points out, until we recover that as a result of interfaith dialogue, we will always be burdened by the inability through purely political means to achieve the common good. So I think that in a way, the challenge is on us as members of the faith communities to recall that transcendent truth in unison and to honor it by our actions and our commitment to it.
Okay, and Salam, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, just as an example, I mean, there are teachings of the faith that change throughout time. I remember a time when in our community, music was considered forbidden. And even going to a church or a synagogue was considered, you know, not deviating from the faith, but really pushing it on the brink. And look at us now. We have Muslim hip hop artists and so many other forms of music in our community. So when a person says, you know, my political opinions or personal opinions, any opinion for that matter, is not aligned with the teachings of my faith, I would say, I think you need to rethink what the teachings of your faith are and look at what Richard said, that the truth that comes, the transcendent truth that comes from the faith, which are, again, are common and simple. It's mercy, compassion, justice, human dignity, freedom. These are the truths that come from all of our faiths.
Okay, thank you. We have two questions that are related, so I'm going to provide both of them and ask for your comments. The first one is, how do we seek unity and reconciliation with justice, and the with justice was capitalized, for those who have been excluded and oppressed? And then the second question, which relates to this, is, do you see examples of congregations of people of color and white congregations forming significant partnerships to deal with this issue of healing and reconciliation? Any of you who'd like to comment on that?
I think we're seeing daily diverse congregations or congregations of color coming together to work on various needs of their own particular communities. One of the things that we would like to see more of, that is, of course, today there are many blacks who attend the white church happily. But unfortunately, that's a one-way street. We're not seeing whites coming over to black churches. Therein, again, we see a problem, but from the standpoint of congregations working together, black and white and or, I think we're doing a good job of that. Now, my fear is, I think age-old words like humanism kind of slips in, because humanism, from its basic understanding, is man being predominant and leaving God out. And because of that, we are beginning to see people wanting credits for themselves, for man's sake, and not so much as to the glory of God. And that presents. You want me to preach some more?
No, that was very good.
Great.
Cassandra, any thoughts on your part on this, or any examples of white and non-white congregations coming together in meaningful partnerships?
Yes. One of the things that I wanted to say is that I heard some time ago that Dr. Tony Evans preached, and in his sermon, he said, God can do anything he wants to do, but God cannot be second. And I see through COVID that many of us came to the realization that we had placed our political views, our race, our location, and our beliefs first before God. And every religion, no matter who you are, every faith says that God is first. And in that time that we spent alone in our homes, we were all forced to go to the internet. And that internet opened our world. So as many of us did not come to the houses of worship, to the building, many of us went to the houses of worship through the internet, and you saw people from every faith, every nationality, white and black, Hispanic, people who were Asian, all come together on one accord in unity for prayer, for help, to assist with the COVID vaccination, to lend a hand to people who were hungry, to reach out to those who were homeless, to bring a meal to those who had no meal, as we talk about the marginalized. And so the beauty, if you could say, in the midst of that all, is that once we were forced not to go to the building, we were able to put aside many of our boundaries and come together for the good of mankind.
Terrific. Now, here is a great question. Some several of you might have thoughts on this. How might we involve young people in the rebuilding process? And I'm just curious if you think it has to take a different approach or different tactics to reach young people as opposed to older individuals.
Well, I feel like we're not going to come to a resolution unless we do involve young people, because it is about the future. And each of us, again, I think all the faiths preach to us the need to build for the future. And so we have to accommodate young people in terms of culture, in terms of thinking, in terms of even speech. But at the end of the day, I believe young people want to be involved in any movement for social justice. And that's central to our faiths. We cannot have truth and reconciliation without justice. And young people are tired of religions that are more insular, are just becoming more and more isolated, and in fact become irrelevant. They want to be relevant in society. I believe there's still a search for God and spirituality among young people, even if they don't belong to any organized religion.
Nathan, any thoughts from you in terms of how to reach young people?
I would just note that within the Jewish community, one of the interesting, the Pew Research Center just a few weeks ago brought out a major demographic survey of the Jewish community, like they've done for other faith communities. And it happened to show that the Orthodox segment, the more traditional segment of the Jewish community, is actually the youngest segment now in the United States. A third of American Jews under the age of 20 or so self-identify as Orthodox. And I think in the case of the Jewish community, and I suspect the case, my colleagues can correct me if I'm wrong, of other communities, younger people are looking for authenticity as much as anything else. And the faith communities that are able to engage younger folks with an authentic voice rooted in the faith, and again, as we've discussed for the past while, and a component of that for each of our faiths is recognizing the dignity of difference, can help draw them into this enterprise as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. I agree with that emphasis on authenticity. That is really important to young people. We have time for one more question. Someone has asked, what efforts are being made by progressive religious leaders to reach out to evangelicals on this topic of healing and reconciliation? And then a second part of that is, have evangelical leaders been receptive to having this kind of dialogue?
In fact, I was just at two evangelical churches in the past 2 weeks, and that's part of our program. You know, we should not stereotype one another. We're all victims of stereotyping, but we also are culprits of stereotyping. There's this notion of each of our religions as being monolithic, and definitely for Christians, it's not monolithic. And for evangelical churches, there are many that want to engage, want to open up, want to have dialogue about these issues. So I was in Phoenix, Arizona, and Orange County, where we had people come together, and there was, I have to say, it was very inspirational, and we need to do more of that and include them in this movement, this coalition that we have formed here. So I believe that the voice of any religion is not represented by a single person, other than, in some church, in some religions, there is that religious hierarchy in terms of theology, but in terms of community sentiment, in terms of opinion, we have to speak directly to them rather than have the media or any other political vehicle speak for them.
Yes, I want to strongly affirm that. I think that's absolutely right. The USCCB, along with a couple of other Catholic organizations, is a member of an organization called the Circle of Protection, which is a group of over 20 Christian denominations, including the evangelicals, who are very active and contribute greatly to the work of the Circle, which concentrates on anti-poverty programs and making sure that those in need, the marginalized communities, are being effectively ministered to by the government and by society as a whole. And I think that comes back to the point made previously by other members of the panel. If we can avoid doctrinal controversy and focus on the core values of mutual support and assistance, I think we'll find common cause with many members of the faith community. And certainly the evangelicals, I think, would be very happy to participate in that project as well.
Terrific. Well, I think we're going to make that the benediction on this discussion. But I do want to thank Salam, Cassandra, Richard, Nathan, and Randy. All of you had terrific insights into this. I like the emphasis on the importance of listening to other people and engaging in dialogue as a way to facilitate healing and reconciliation. And those of you who are interested in the paper, John Allen and I wrote, you can find that on the Brookings website at brookings.edu. It's our plans and some of our ideas on how to promote healing and reconciliation. So thank you very much. We appreciate the audience tuning in. And again, thank you to the panelists for taking the time to contribute your thoughts on this important topic. Thank you very much.